WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bosnian Serbs voted down the Vance-Owen peace plan earlier this week, and new UN sanctions against the Serbs are now in effect. The debate about whether we should take military action against the Serbs has intensified. My guest, Arye Nair, is the executive director of the human rights group Human Rights Watch. They've just issued the second volume of a report on war crimes in Bosnia. The report calls for a war crimes tribunal and criticizes the international community for failing to stop attempted genocide. Nair was in Sarajevo during the first week of April. This marked the first anniversary of the siege of Sarajevo. Conditions seemed to have temporarily improved. A ceasefire was in effect, and the harsh winter was ending.
More important, I think, than those things were what I sensed as an intensification of the city's sense of its own multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multicultural character, and a determination by quite a lot of people to celebrate that, even as they were being attacked for that. I've come to believe that the siege of Sarajevo is not only a matter of ethnic cleansing, but I think it also represents an anti-urbanism, an anti-cosmopolitanism, and the city is loathed by a lot of the people who are attacking it. They precisely loathe that multi-ethnic, multi-religious character of the city. They're doing their best to destroy it, and some of the citizens of Sarajevo, a lot of the citizens of Sarajevo, are taking all the more pride in that character of the city.
It's an interesting perspective. What led you to the conclusion that part of the reason for the siege of Sarajevo is that it's urban and pluralistic?
Well, one talks to people on both sides of the conflict. One tries to read their materials, and one gets a sense of that from the way they describe Sarajevo. It appears as though the attacks on the city have been aimed at the destruction of the varied cultural monuments of the city. The city had five centuries under Ottoman rule, and therefore it has an old Turkish quarter and Muslim and mosques which reflect that history, but it also had an Austro-Hungarian past. It has Catholic churches, Orthodox churches, synagogues, and all of those have been targets. I would say that the single building which seems to have been shelled more than any other is probably the National Library, and it's the building that people mourn particularly in Sarajevo. Another major target has been Oslo Bajenje, the newspaper, and it still functions from the basement of the building, but upstairs everything is destroyed. It appears that the shelling has the aspect of a cultural war, that is, wiping out the cultural symbols and the diversity of the city.
You actually went to a multicultural seder while you were in Sarajevo. What
Yes.
was it like?
Well, it was quite extraordinary. It was extraordinary because the main language that was used was Ladino, and Ladino is a dialect of Spanish, and it reflects the fact that the Sarajevan Jews came to Sarajevo five centuries ago at the time of the expulsion from Spain, and they have preserved Ladino. So it wasn't only that the passages from the Seder were read and chanted in Ladino, but in addition, the leader of the community made a welcoming speech to the community in Ladino. In addition, the chief Muslim cleric of the former Yugoslavia was one of the guests. The Catholic Archbishop of Bosnia was one of the guests. The leader of the Orthodox community of Sarajevo was there. A representative of the Seventh-day Adventists were there. And I thought that this demonstration of all the religious groups taking part in the Seder was intended as a manifestation of this pride in the multi-religious and multi-ethnic traditions of the city.
Your group has been calling for a war crimes tribunal. This week, lawyers with the United Nations War Crimes Commission said that they had little confidence that a war crimes tribunal could amount to anything, because as long as the Serbs are still in power, there's no way anyone in a real position of power will be tried, and it's unlikely that the Serbs will emerge defeated. The Lawyers also said that it's likely that the first cases that would be tried in a war crimes tribunal would be against middle or lower level people. So it's still up in the air whether the Security Council will pursue this or not. Do you think there's still any point in pursuing it?
Yes, I think there is very much of a point. I disagree with the statements that were attributed to the lawyers who were quoted in the press. The lawyer who was quoted principally was Commander Fenrick, a Canadian lawyer who was one of the five members of the Commission of Experts on War Crimes that the UN established last October. And I must say I've been quite disappointed with that commission. I don't think that it has worked nearly as hard as it should have. I would exempt from that the one American or Egyptian-American on that commission, a Professor Sherif Basuni of DePaul University in Chicago, who I think has to some extent made up for the laxity by the other members of the commission. My view is that if you bring war crimes prosecutions, the same sequence should be followed as was followed at Nuremberg and at Tokyo after World War II. That is, the people with the highest level of responsibility for the most egregious crimes should be tried first. I don't think it's as difficult to bring prosecutions against those people as has been suggested. One of the provisions of what is called the first additional protocol to the Geneva Conventions, and this is a protocol which sets out many of the war crimes which would be considered by such a tribunal, is that commanders and leaders who have information on war crimes that are being committed under their direction and who do not take all feasible measures within their power to prevent and suppress war crimes are themselves guilty of war crimes. Which means that General Mladic or Radovan Karadzic or any other leader in this conflict would have to show that they took steps to try to end the detention of civilians in detention camps, that they took steps to try to end the shelling of civilian population centers such as Sarajevo or Cerska or Srebrenica, that they took steps to end the rapes and the mass killings. They can't show that. They didn't take those steps. So I think that the possibility of convicting them would be very great.
Well, how do you bring somebody like Radovan Karadzic, who is the head of the Bosnian Serbs, how do you get him to come and stand trial while he's still in a position of power, while people are still trying to convince him to negotiate or to sign on to a peace plan, you know?
I don't think it'll happen in 3 months or 6 months, but I do think that if international sanctions are maintained for an extended period, at some point the Bosnian Serbs would turn him over. Bear in mind that there have been war crimes trials resulting from World War II up to the present moment. And if you have a tribunal, and if the world community is willing to be patient and leave that tribunal in place, at some point, he is going to be turned over. At the very least, he would never be able to venture outside the borders of his own country. And how many countries are willing to be pariahs for the very long term?
My guest is Arye Nair, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. The group has just issued Volume 2 of its report on war crimes in Bosnia. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Arye Nair, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. The UN has taken a beating from many critics in how it's been handling Bosnia. In February, your group, Human Rights Watch, called on Cyrus Vance to halt peace negotiations until war crimes like ethnic cleansing were halted and until humanitarian assistance was allowed to be delivered to civilians in besieged communities. Why did you want Cyrus Vance to stop peace negotiations until then?
Well, it seemed to us plain that the peace negotiations were being used by the Serbs as a cover for the continuation of ethnic cleansing. The mediators were calling on the international community not to intervene forcefully in the conflict on the ground that this would disrupt the peace negotiations. That's what the Serbs wanted. It allowed them to keep cleaning people out, keep shelling these civilian cities, and more war crimes were being committed while these negotiations were taking place, and I think they were taking place in bad faith on the Serbian side. That seems more apparent in retrospect than it did at the time, but it seemed fairly apparent even at that moment.
Now that the Bosnian Serbs have voted down the peace plan, do you think that that peace plan is dead?
I'm not sure it's dead, because I think that there is another cynical maneuver that is possible. I think it's possible that at this moment they will reconsider and they will sign the peace plan. But at this moment, they will have altered the situation on the ground. They will have driven people away in increasing numbers and have made more and more parts of the country ethnically pure. And then they will count on the fact that the international community will not demonstrate the will to repatriate people to the areas that have been cleaned out. And people won't want to go back if the areas remain dangerous, if their houses have been destroyed, if they can't make a livelihood in returning to those places. And so the peace plan will continue to appear to legitimize what I think has been a horrendous set of events.
You criticize the international community for lack of will. Sanctions are going into effect against Serbia now. Does that sound effective to you?
Well, it certainly is a lot better than nothing. I think that if the war crimes tribunal were created, that too would be a lot better than nothing. But there is a solemn duty that the international community undertook when it adopted the Genocide Convention and when various nations of the world ratified the Genocide Convention. The nations that ratified the Genocide Convention pledged that they would act through the United Nations to prevent and suppress genocide. They have not done so. And then the question arises, what's the meaning of an international treaty if the governments that are parties to that international treaty are not willing to honor their obligations under it?
What recommendations would you have for upholding the convention?
Well, at this point, let me say that I'm speaking personally, because I'm going to go beyond the policies of the organization that I have directed, Human Rights Watch. My own view is that at this date, there really is not any alternative to military action. I think it's possible that if at an earlier point the U.S. and the U.N. had intervened more forcefully, had simply said, we declare these places safe havens, you may not attack them, that that might have been successful. I doubt that at this late date that something of that sort would succeed. I would start in that fashion. I would start by saying, if you continue to attack these places, there will be retaliations against your artillery. And I think that that would have some effect. I can't say what effect it would have.
When was the last time you supported military action?
It's been a long time. I can't recall very well. I will recall this, and that is I was a childhood refugee from Nazi Germany. I lived in England during World War II. I certainly never thought that there was any alternative other than military action in trying to defeat the Nazis.
I wonder if you find that there's a new set of alliances and kind of shifting alliances on the issue of what to do in Bosnia. I mean, for example, also on our show today is former Secretary of State George Shultz, mm-hmm. who also feels that there should be some kind of military intervention in Bosnia. President Clinton isn't sure about that and is thinking that over, but says that a stronger policy on the Balkans is needed. But I wonder if you find yourself siding with people who you've never sided with before.
Well, I've told a number of people, and shocked some of my friends by saying this, that I am nostalgic for Margaret Thatcher, that I'd love to see somebody with her kind of backbone in public office today.
And you never would have said that before?
I never would have said that before.
My guest is Arye Nair, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. My guest is Arye Nair, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. I'm wondering if you think, you know, a lot of the people in Bosnia, particularly in Sarajevo, are urban, middle class. And I think, you know, I think there's an identification that a lot of middle class Americans feel with a lot of the people in Bosnia.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you think that's affecting the sentiment of those people in their desire for military intervention.
I'm sure it is.
Because there's this sense of identification.
I'm sure it is that if something horrendous takes place in Sudan, it's more difficult for middle-class Americans, middle-class Westerners to identify with, let's say, the people in the Nuba Mountains in Sudan. We have only a remote idea where that is. We don't get that much information on what's happening to them. Or if we think, let's say, about the Rohingya Muslims in Burma, who have been treated abominably by the Burmese government and have suffered terribly, again, those people are so remote, we know so little about them. And I worry about this matter of intervening in Europe when we don't respond to comparable abuses that have taken place in other parts of the world. The other side of that coin, however, is that there is always the excuse that we didn't know what was happening in those remote places. We don't understand those remote places. When it comes to Bosnia, everybody has been informed on what's taking place. It's on the front page of the newspapers every day. It's on radio and television every day. So when we know it all and when we have it right close to us because it's in the center of Europe, if we are unable to act under those circumstances, my view is, how can we possibly respond to what is taking place in a Sudan or in a Burma? I would hope that if the West or if the international community responds to what is taking place in Bosnia, that some of the dictators and demagogues and those who are fomenting ethnic and religious strife in other parts of the world and causing these great disasters would begin to wonder whether the international community would respond to them too, and I would hope that would have some deterrent value.
Do you think about the dangers that we might risk in getting involved militarily in Bosnia?
Yes, of course. There certainly are dangers. I don't want to say that one should ever approach the idea of military involvement lightly. I am not advocating the use of ground troops, and it's not that I have any special repugnance at the use of ground troops, but I am influenced by all of the comments that people make that we don't want to get into a quagmire. But I do think that the use of military force would reflect a willingness by the international community to do something significant with respect to the crime of genocide that is taking place in circumstances where everybody knows about it. And I think for the sake of the international community, as much as for the sake of the people in Bosnia, it's important that the world should respond to what is taking place.
I want to ask you, I know you'll be leaving Human Rights Watch in mid-May for another position.
Yes.
What are some of the greatest frustrations you've experienced in your years heading Human Rights Watch?
Well, the great frustrations are that one, on the one hand, seems to be making a certain amount of progress in dealing with human rights because there's a greater consciousness of human rights worldwide than there was, let's say, a decade ago or a decade and a half ago. On the other hand, the number of abuses of human rights doesn't seem to diminish. There doesn't seem to be some great advance in mitigating the violation of human rights because of the strengthened human rights movement worldwide. And as I see the proliferation of ethnic and religious conflict in the wake of the end of the Cold War, one wonders whether the fall of communism has produced the kinds of great advances in human rights that had been anticipated 3 or 4 years ago.
When you're dealing with work that's very frustrating, and I'm sure it's very frustrating to try to get governments to respect human rights in many parts of the world, you remind yourself of victories that you've had, that it is possible to achieve victory. What are some of the victories you've reminded yourself about over the years to kind of give you the energy to go on?
Well, I think there have been a great many victories in Latin America. When I started with Human Rights Watch, the southern cone of Latin America, that is Argentina and Chile and Uruguay and Paraguay, all had military dictatorships. And the human rights abuses in those countries were horrendous. Disappearances, summary executions, torture on a massive scale. I think that the human rights efforts that focused on those countries were a major factor in producing transformations, and those countries largely respect human rights today. So I'm delighted with the transformation that has taken place in that region. Elsewhere in Latin America, there have also been changes. El Salvador was the country on which I personally focused much more than any other for a period of several years. And I think that El Salvador has emerged from its nightmare. I think that there is a good prospect that El Salvador will respect human rights in the years to come. And the role that we played in helping to bring to an end the death squad killings and the bombings of civilians in the countryside was probably an important part of the transformation.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Arye Nair is the outgoing director of Human Rights Watch. He's also a columnist for The Nation. He soon becomes president of the Open Society Fund. I'm Terry Gross.